Mr. Ellis.
Good evening, City Council. The item in front of you for consideration is the establishment of a human rights ordinance. Before we get too involved, I just want to take a few moments and kind of walk through the history and bring folks up to speed in terms of how we got here. In January of 2009, City Council authorized the establishment of the Dialogue on Race. In 2011, the Government Action Team of the Dialogue on Race put forth a proposal for the establishment of the Charlottesville Commission on Human Rights, Diversity, and Race Relations. In February of 2012, City Council approved the establishment of a Human Rights Task Force to first determine if the City of Charlottesville needed a Human Rights Commission, and if so, what model would be appropriate for the City of Charlottesville. The Human Rights Task Force met for 8 months, visiting and speaking with human rights commissions throughout the state to learn more about the roles of the human rights commissions, but also to learn about the outcomes that they were able to establish. The Human Rights Task Force also collected data from victims of alleged discrimination and referred them to appropriate agencies to work with. They also held multiple town hall meetings, hearing from folks in the community about acts of discrimination. Members of the group also met and had met on a monthly basis and shared personal stories about being victims of discrimination or witnessing discrimination here in the city or in their lifetime. When it came down to come up with a recommendation, all members of the Human Rights Task Force agreed that there's some level of discrimination here in the city of Charlottesville. Where things differed were what would be the best way to address discrimination in the city. Three of the recommendations that came from the Human Rights Task Force were that the city should develop a strong anti-discrimination ordinance. The city should form a human rights commission that is enabled to utilize the full scope and remedies provided by state and federal statutes to uphold the ordinance. And the city should ensure comprehensive anti-discrimination education and training opportunities are available for all residents and businesses within the city. On February 4th of this year, we held the first reading on the human rights ordinance, which you have in front of you. That prohibited discrimination in housing, public accommodation, credit, and education on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions, national origin, age, marital status, or disability. In this ordinance, the Human Rights Commission would not engage in investigation of complaints, but provided future counsel the ability to convey that authority to the commission by vote. The city, also within that partnership, the city would, and the city has established a partnership with the EEOC where they would expand their presence here in the city of Charlottesville and would work out of the city one day a month, and we would also strengthen our partnership with PHA. Sometimes what has gotten forgotten about the Human Rights Commission are some of the other aspects that we've asked them to consider doing. One looked at systemic and institutional change. The other one was community awareness and also community dialogue. We've talked a lot about the investigation piece, which is extremely important, but there's also a lot of work that the commission would be responsible for in terms of working with members of the community business leaders and residents to educate individuals on what discrimination is and how we can prevent discrimination in our community. On March 4th, an amendment to the original ordinance was proposed, and while there are many similarities to the ordinance, there are some differences, and I'd just like to draw your attention to, within your packet, there's a comparison between the two ordinances. It's a column sheet. And if you look, there are, as I mentioned, quite a few similarities, but I just want to touch briefly on what some of the differences are. In Section 2-432, Human Rights Commission, the original version talked about did not include third-party contracting. In the alternate version of version B, the director is responsible for coordination between the commission and any party contracting with the city to provide investigatory services. Section 2-433C, role of the Human Rights Commission. Initially, in the original version, it did not include mediation, conducting hearings as tools to assist those who have been victims of discrimination. The alternative version actually includes those, and it would be utilizing the third-party contractor. Another difference in the two were duties and responsibilities of the commission. What the original version provided the city manager with the authority to contract with, form partnerships to facilitate receipt and processing of individual complaints of discrimination. In version B, it provides the city manager with the authority to enter into a partnership, but also to contract with the third party contractor. Section 2-437, duties and responsibilities and future enforcement. The first one, as I mentioned, provides a passageway for city council to provide, if a future city council wanted to provide the enforcement ability to the commission. That is in there. In version B, it's already been bestowed upon the commission. So after our previous meeting, staff was asked to go out and actually look into the feasibility of the alternative version, try to develop some numbers that could be put around the proposal. What we found there, we could not find any localities in Virginia that were actually contracting out the third party investigatory piece. We actually couldn't find any in the United States. The director of the Prince William County Human Rights Commission referred me to the federal government, where we were able to find quite a few private companies who actually provide EEOC investigative services for the federal government. Makes me worry about the federal government a little more. But we were able to have a conversation with some of those folks, and the numbers they provided us are reflective in the proposal in front of you. And we recognize that it's not an apples-to-apples comparison, and the numbers would probably be somewhat lower just due to the complexity of the federal government employment. But for budgeting purposes, we went with what they provided us on a local level, and those numbers would range, I believe, from 2,800 to 3,200, possibly 4,000 to investigate cases. And that's just for investigation. Mediation services was something different. And so what you have in front of you is the research that staff did in terms of the alternative version. And I believe there may be an amendment to the version that Councilor Zekos...
Could you also mention the mediation? What did you find out?
Mediation services would be about $190 an hour.
And before we have a public hearing...
Rates?
Those were rates that we received from the contractors. From the federal government.
The federal contractors. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of mediators here. Mm-hmm.
Before we have a public hearing, I would like to ask Seiko's was just some amendments to first version to explain those also.
I've been trying to listen to some of the concerns as we've discussed these first two versions to see if there was something that we could do that wouldn't be starting over, but that would bring in both recommendations from the task force and things that we've been hearing both from counselors and from people who are coming before us, both in the public meetings that the task force had, in the report that the task force did, and in other ways that people have come forward. And so I submitted the original version of the ordinance with some amendments on Friday, and I believe it was put online, and so it's been there for people to look at. There's nothing really new in it. It's just some of it is moved around within the ordinance, and some of it is... was it minority report of the task force. And it basically, one concern that I know I had was that what we might end up with was a human rights ordinance that said that discrimination is illegal in the city, but we don't have any way to actually make that happen. And that we can talk about it, but that we can't actually look at when it does happen and do anything about it. And so what this would do would be to make it a staff position. There would be two, under the current budget we already have, it's two full-time staff people. So this envisions one of those staff people, whether it's the director or the other, as the person who does all intake of complaints of actual violations of civil rights under the local ordinance. The complaints that would be eligible for review by the EEOC or through PHA or where somebody is already doing that locally, the complaint would come through the city but then be assigned to those agencies that they would be dealt with here locally. And that any cases that are covered by our ordinance and covered by state and federal regulations but are not covered by somebody doing investigations currently, such as smaller employers, education, public services, the categories that are covered that the EEOC does not deal with, we would do in-house. And so, I could read what I have, or I can give a slightly more informal descriptive version, and maybe I can count on our attorney to call me if there's anything that I'm saying that isn't written in here, because I know that what I wrote, he was able to take and put into totally legal language and make sure there were no contradictions. So the idea is that somebody would feel that they had been complained against, they would bring it to the city staff person, the commissioner, and say, I feel that I was discriminated against, I didn't get a loan at this bank, or I didn't get this job. And the person would look at the complaint and see on its face, if everything you say is true, that might be a violation. Or if everything you say is true, that's just not illegal. And sometimes a case might be resolved right there when a person didn't really understand what the law was. But if it does rise to the next level, would then go to the person or the organization against whom the complaint has been filed and get their side of the story, offer mediation to the two sides if there isn't a quick resolution, offer mediation in that case in-house. There is, I think, in the ordinance, the possibility that if it were needed to contract that out, that would be allowable. But I'm envisioning, in most cases, the precedents that we've seen in other localities show that most of these cases are going to be resolved in those first two steps, either in it not really being a violation or within mediation. And at that point, if they go through mediation and mediation does not resolve the issue, then the director, the commissioner, would continue the investigation, finish the investigation, and come to a finding, either of dismissing it, saying that there was no violation found, or a finding of a violation of the local code, the local ordinance against human rights. And while state law does not allow us at this point, from what I understand, to actually prosecute that under our local ordinance, it does give the person who's filed the complaint validation of what they've said happened, that somebody who really knows how these things works say it really did happen, so that if they then can be given guidance for how to take that to court or whatever they're going to do next with that. It's not, unfortunately, binding. I would prefer that it were, but I don't, this is where I'm trying to find a way through for it that we can all agree to. But it does save somebody if they feel they've been violated from hiring a lawyer, going through the legal process when there are other ways to deal with it. So I think for 90 to 95% of cases, this will handle everything that they need. For those few cases that go beyond, what I'm hoping will happen is that we'll see what sort of need there is, because we'll be dealing with violations, we'll be dealing with accusations, and we'll be resolving them locally so that people will be able to bring those to us so we can actually use that caseload to collect data for what the need is in the community. And I would strongly urge us to go ahead and ask, and this is not in the ordinance, but to ask the legislature for enforcement authority so that if we then at that point decide, after going through this for a certain period, that we need enforcement, we would be able to get it. So that is basically, am I missing anything critical in our thing? So I won't discuss it, but that's just kind of what's in there.
So this is basically addendum to the pending version.
Yes, under the same budget. No new topics, no new budget.
Okay. Any comments before we open a public hearing?
Can I just clarify something? So the commission itself doesn't come into play in your version?
Not in this version.
Okay. Except for the other two components, correct?
Oh, and all the other stuff.
All the other stuff.
But in this amendment, yeah.
In disputes, it doesn't ever.
It doesn't have a hearing.
No hearings. There's no public hearing.
It retains the language for future enforcement if council at some future date decides to implement those portions of the ordinance that's built into it.
So what it's basically done is taken all the investigation stuff out of future and put it in present and keep the enforcement in future.
So are there any other clarifications needed before we open a public hearing? If not, I'll open a public hearing. The first person to sign is Abigail Turner. And this, as you know, this public hearing is the both versions, including the amendment.
Everything's game.
Thank you. I want to thank the council first for the time that you spent in working on this issue. We know it's been time-consuming that you've heard from a lot of people. I'm Abigail Turner. I'm of counsel for the Legal Aid Justice Center, whose offices are here in Charlottesville. Our director, Alex Galata, unfortunately had a prior commitment in Richmond tonight and cannot be here. So I speak for the Legal Aid Justice Center, and I also speak as a member of the Human Rights Task Force. First of all, I want to talk about the institutionalized discrimination provisions. We support the work that the different proposals say should be done about institutionalized discrimination. We agree that there are some institutions in the city that need closer scrutiny from the perspective of their human rights treatment of citizens and of other residents in the city. We urge you to give word to and power to, as the proposals do, to have a continuing dialogue about human rights, to expand the dialogue on race to be a dialogue on human rights. And we think the third logical piece of this is a strong process to allow individuals who've been discriminated against to get help from the city in resolving those issues. I participated in the dialogue on race and all the individual sessions and the larger sessions, and I think we heard a lot of frustrated citizens, both African American and white, who thought that for too long the city had had before them anecdotal stories as well as statistics to demonstrate there's not racial equity in Charlottesville. And so we think that this council needs to take the next step and have a powerful tool for those individuals to be recompensed, to have their stories heard, to have some advice about whether they're, as Council Member Zacho said, whether this is illegal discrimination, but not to stop there, to let the commission hear their claims and recommend the remedy that they should receive. As you know, in some of the proposals that are before you, the city would have power to ask the city attorney to enforce what the commission finds. And we ask you to keep that, because we think that the institutionalized piece will not be nearly as strong in getting concrete recommendations if you don't have the individual piece to show people who may be violating the law that the city is serious. Now, there's been some questions about how you can do this and real concerns about whether the individual piece might eat up all the resources that you have are allocating to this activity. You have the power of the purse strings. You have the authority to say, we want this to be the maximum amount of money that will be spent on individual cases. We don't know what's going to happen in individual cases. There are likely to be a significant number because the city has not been in a position to help people in the past who have individual issues. But you can control that by what you do with allocation of the money. We hope that you will reject any suggestions that I've seen in some emails about relying on the Office of the Virginia Attorney General to do anything to protect human rights. That's not their business. They don't have a track record of doing that. And what we're talking about is local help and local enforcement. So we really encourage you to go to that. Finally, I want to comment very quickly on the issue about how much individual complaints will cost. The numbers I have seen are $3,000 and $4,000 per complaint. Those are from Northern Virginia, and I think those are much higher than we would be spending in Charlottesville. For example, assume that the work on those complaints costs $50 an hour. $4,000 would be 80 hours per case. That is not reasonable.
Timing.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. We appreciate that. Timothy Hilbert.
Took me a while to get here, Mr. Mayor. You're already running my clock. My name is Timothy Hilbert. I work for the Charlottesville Regional Chamber of Commerce, which is down the road and across the street, one block. We'll be commemorating our 100th anniversary later this week on Thursday and Friday, and I'm always happy to be here in front of the city council. Well, not always, but most of the time. I also am a resident of the city. I live on Brandywine Drive. Our chamber supports enactment of a strong, unequivocal city ordinance, reaffirming the city's full support for federal and state anti-discrimination statutes. Our chamber concurs with the task force about the efficacy of a local city venue for citizens to bring complaints of discrimination forward and for the establishment of a local city authority to ameliorate matters between parties towards resolution. And, of course, we continue to believe that the dialogue on race has merit. We respectfully disagree, however, with proposals for an appointed city human rights commission with an investigatory subpoena enforcement authority with no apparent appeal. Our chamber has continuing serious concerns about the nature, scope, jurisdiction, authority, and operation of such a tribunal. Our chamber member enterprises have communicated very grave concerns about the unintended adverse consequences of such a mechanism, raising, among other things, the specter of business and jobs relocation from the city. In establishing such a panel, the city runs a high risk of treading on ground rife with complexity and exposing the city, its taxpayers, and in fact the commissioners themselves to unsuspected repercussion. Our chamber offers a different, prudent, non-political, and professional approach. I can tell you that I have not seen, I don't sit hovering over the internet waiting to see what's going to get posted on any website on a Friday afternoon, so I haven't seen your piece, Councillor Zekos, although I have to tell you, hearing this this evening, it sounds like a major step in the right direction, where we can have this local authority. That's something that's very important. That is a missing ingredient. That needs to happen here. But a politically appointed tribunal with subpoena power, with no apparent appeal process, is not something that our chamber can support. And I don't think you can get the mechanics of that through the General Assembly on enforcement, and I suspect our chamber and others would oppose that. So I think you're moving in the right direction. It's awfully hard to judge something you haven't seen, so I haven't seen it. But I think you're on the right track in a general sense, but I would reserve final judgment until I saw the darn thing. So thank you. I'm up. Time is up. I yield my rest of my time to Abigail.
Or Henneke.
My name is Walt Heineke. I live at 1521 Amherst Street in the city of Charlottesville. I first wanted to thank you for all of your hard work in trying to figure out the best way to provide anti-discrimination protection for the citizens of Charlottesville. I am especially thankful to Councillors Zekos, Norris, and Smith, who have been trying incredibly hard to craft an ordinance that includes local enforcement and that thinks strategically about costs. The dialogue on race was a promise by the city to, quote, engage every segment of our community in an open, honest, ongoing discussion of race, racism, and diversity, and to identify problems and propose concrete solutions and paths to action that promote racial reconciliation, economic justice, and equity. The intention of the Human Rights Ordinance has always been to eradicate discrimination from Charlottesville and to make this a better place to live for everyone. Sometimes, I've learned, the means or the vehicle of a policy undermines the original intentions of the policy. I think that's what's happening here tonight in this process over the last year. The Jones-Ellis proposal, the Chambers proposal, and the new amendments offered by Councillor Sekos eliminate the enforcement component of the Human Rights Commission. They put all the power in the hands of a human rights director, an advocate that pretty much directs complaints elsewhere. The advocate will be susceptible to special interest pressure, where the Citizen Commission would not be susceptible to that pressure. These proposals deny our citizens the protection against discrimination allowed by the Virginia Human Rights Act. And I disagree with what I heard earlier. The Human Rights Act of Virginia does allow the Human Rights Commission to have public hearings. They deny our citizens from the protection against discrimination offered by such places as Prince William County, Alexandria, Fairfax, Arlington, and Waterloo, Iowa. This despite the fact that we know from an article in the Seville Weekly that the Chamber of Commerce in Prince William County has no problems with their enforcement component, as we read in an article that states, quote, for almost two decades, the Prince William County Human Rights Commission has been receiving and resolving discrimination complaints. Debbie Jones, Executive Vice President at the Prince William County Chamber of Commerce, said, the commission's work hasn't raised the hackles of the business owners her organizations represent. I've been in the chamber world for 22 years, and I don't recall there being anything negative about it, she said, end quote. A commission with no enforcement is not what the people asked for when we had the dialogue on race study circles. In essence, you ignore the recommendations of your own human rights task force and eliminate the enforcement component. You give the people of Charlottesville a bad check, a check that has come back marked insufficient funds. I think you can come to a reasonable compromise tonight by allowing the commission to work with the EEC on cases where employers are larger than 15. But if you eliminate the enforcement capability of the full commission to hold hearings on cases that fail at mediation, you have gone too far and violated the intentions of the original policy proposal. I still have faith that tonight you will find the three votes to give our citizens the best protection allowed by the state law and enable a commission with the Virginia Human Rights Act enforcement ability. This is what droves of citizens who came out to the public hearing in February were asking you to do. Don't send the message to this town tomorrow morning that it's okay to continue to discriminate. Thank you.
Thank you. Paul Lowe.
My name is Paul Long. I live at 1410 Grady Avenue. And I just wanted to come up and say that I'm in favor of the Human Rights Commission with enforcement, you know, capacities. And my home city of Philadelphia was the founding city of the United States. And the problem of race and discrimination has been with this country ever since its founding. And the founding fathers were cowards in allowing slavery to continue in the Constitution. We had to go through a civil war and have the 13th Amendment passed. And even in my lifetime, and I was looking around to see how many people had white hair, but I came of age in the 1960s, and I graduated from high school in 1967. And I remember as a 10-year-old boy, my mother and father talking about Prince Edward County, Virginia, shutting down rather than accepting, you know, desegregation. I remember that, as Mr. Folger commented about, the race riots in the 60s, and I remember, as opposed to him, I think, fond memories of Lyndon Johnson and what he did with the passage of the Civil Rights Acts and the war on poverty. And my father was from New York, my mother was from Louisiana, and I want to say that the problem with race is not just a Southern problem. I'm an amateur student of history. President Franklin Roosevelt had to send federal troops to Philadelphia because when the public transit system was desegregated, the white workers refused to come in and work, and they had to operate the public transit system. I remember Senator Edward Kennedy being chased in the streets of Boston when the city of Boston was ordered to desegregate their schools. So the kind of nonsense and aggravation that I frequently think of as occurring in the South with Lester Maddox, Governor Burnett of Mississippi, has occurred frequently in the North. Racism isn't as terrible as it was 30 or 40 years ago, but it does exist, and the commission should have an educational component as right as well. I know a lot of African-American people who tell me that the businesses in the downtown mall are prejudiced, that there's a prejudice against African-Americans coming to the downtown mall. I don't know whether that's true or not, but the perception a lot of times can be just as bad as the facts. And I think all of Charlottesville has to sit down, as well as the entire country, and discuss this, try to solve it in a good faith measure. Just because Mr. Obama is in the White House as President of the United States, the problem of racial discrimination hasn't gone away, and it still needs to be addressed. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who has not spoken would like to speak?
Yeah, Jeffrey Fogle, 215 Spruce Street here in the city. The first thing I wanted to say is I expected Rod Sterling to get up because this is truly the Twilight Zone. At your last public hearing, you all agreed that this ordinance, however it comes out in terms of enforcement, will prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex, including gender identity, transgender status, or sexual orientation. And then tonight you honored an organization whose policy and practice is to discriminate on that basis. It's unbelievable. Are you really serious? Are you sitting here serious about dealing with the issue of discrimination? How in God's name could you honor the Boy Scouts of America if you're serious about this issue? I was a Boy Scout. I liked the time. I didn't realize when I was 12 years old what they were doing. But when I realized it, I realized that's not an institution that can be supported. And it is just extraordinary. It's unbelievable to me to sit here and hear you say, we're going to outlaw this, and we're going to honor the very entities that engage in that practice. Unbelievable to me. Unbelievable. On the other side, I simply want to say, I do agree with enforcement. I have said before, EEOC does not, and I will repeat this, does not enforce our anti-discrimination laws. They are a gatekeeper for the federal courts. They sometimes mediate. They're sometimes successful at that. They almost never litigate, and they have no basis for resolving any other's complaints. So if you believe that people should have the right to enforce a violation of the anti-discrimination law that you are all agreed should be passed, the only way to do that is locally. And if you exclude all of the entities that are subject to the jurisdiction of the EEOC, which is those entities which I think employ 15 people or more, you've said everybody who works for a large company, you don't get an enforcement mechanism, only if you work for a small company. In fact, the truth is it should be the reverse, which is why it was set that way in the original Title VII. Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else who would like to speak?
Let's bring the whole chair.
He'll get enough time.
I'll only need a minute and a half. I'm Peter Kleeman. I live at 407 Hedge Street in the city. I can't claim to be an expert on what is under the umbrella of human rights. Clearly, there's many forms of discrimination on age, sex, various handicaps, etc. But in my experience, the forms of discrimination or the actual events occur locally within the community. It's with our neighbors, with our bosses, with our landlords, with service providers, businesses, etc. So these are local problems. And the way I look at resolving problems of a legal or quasi-legal issue is that you go to the most local level to solve local problems. In our courts, we have cases held where the crimes are committed in the communities where these things happen. And it seems to me that that's a great guideline for us to consider in a human rights commission. So my feeling is that these being locally experienced events, and that we need to grow as a community if these are occurring within our community, I think to the extent possible, all of the issues that can be addressed locally should be addressed locally. If enforcement can be done local, it should be done locally. If investigations can be done locally, it should be done locally. If we need to include members of our own community we as a community will grow. We will become much better at understanding what are the nuances of violations of human rights and forms of discrimination that occur here, and we as a community can solve those problems better locally than relying on state, federal, or other organizations to do it for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else would like to speak? Not to close the public hearing. Discussion with the council.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis, did we ever get any more clarification on whether the EEOC would mediate locally?
Yes, the EEOC, we, city manager and I spoke to Daryl Graham, the director, and the EEOC is open to having mediation occur locally.
Thank you.
Any questions?
I have a couple questions for Ms. Sakis. What is the, what would be the motivation for a an employer or landlord who's been accused of discrimination to engage in mediation if there's no legal consequences for him or her not to do so?
Well, I think, I mean, I, as you know, am an advocate for enforcement. So, you know, for me, this is a compromise position. And so I think that, but I do see that it has more, they have more of a, of an impetus than they would under what we had previously. I think that, that most employers in the community want to do the right thing, and if somebody has a problem with them, they want to sit down and talk to them. I think that's what I, what, one of the real values, as Mr. Kleeman was talking about, in dealing locally with local issues. These are local issues, and you know, most businesses, if it was unintentional or they don't feel that they've discriminated intentionally or at all, they're going to want to come and clear the air and talk to each other. If it's somebody who has intentionally violated the law, I don't know. Maybe nothing.
I guess I wonder if you would be open to a friendly amendment to your amendment that would allow some recourse, and you know, we can sort of wordsmith it, but some recourse for cases where you do have an employer or a landlord. And there is, and the evidence indicates that there is, in fact, an egregious act of discrimination that's occurred, where the director of the commission isn't just telling the complainant, you know, good luck, but actually is assisting that complainant in pursuing legal recourse through the courts. As some people have said, the city cannot issue fines or that kind of thing under existing legislation, but we certainly can assist individuals in pursuing legal remedies through the courts.
Well, one thing it already includes, and I think that's an interesting idea, one of the things it already includes is that if the parties are not able to find solutions through mediation, whether that's having gone through it or not, that the investigation would still go forward. So there would be an investigation under this.
Right.
So what you're asking for is after the finding has been found that there is a violation, then having the city attorney do that?
Yeah, creating some mechanism. Again, I'm open to ideas on how that could work. But there is a process envisioned under state law that would, that allows the city to assist an individual where you know, the investigation indicates that a violation has occurred. It allows the city to support an individual in pursuing legal remedies. So I just wonder if you're open to that idea.
Well, I'm only open to it if it doesn't bring the whole thing down.
May I ask a technical question then of our attorney? How could that work? What does that mean, that you as the city attorney then would assist the director in assisting a complainant?
I'm not sure which Councilor Norris meant. I would be comfortable assisting the director. I can't represent a private party. I wouldn't undertake.
There's a process. So it's already spelled out under the future legislative authority here, which talks about, you know, if there is a case where a finding has occurred of a violation, and I'm where
it goes to the Human Rights Commission.
What is the number on that? Just to find it.
Well, that's what I'm trying to find now.
I think it's on page 7.
but I haven't found it
My
yet.
My memory is that it goes...
Okay, if the commission finds that a respondent has committed a violation of this ordinance and determines that the appropriate remedial measures have not been taken, the commission, through the city attorney and subject to approval by the city council, may file an appropriate action in any court of competent jurisdiction to prove de novo that the respondent violated this chapter, secure compliance with this chapter, and or obtain appropriate relief available under any applicable state or federal statute or regulation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Which version?
That's under section 2-439.2 under Ms. Sakis's...
But that's under the future enforcement
it's
authority.
Under future
right, so my question is would you be willing for, I'm guessing we're talking about a tiny handful of cases each year where it's the opinion of the director that an egregious violation has occurred rather than just simply saying you're on your own to the complainant, but that we actually assist them in pursuing legal remedy.
And so I guess I would ask the city attorney, is that possible?
Well, I think the way it's set up now is after the director's determination, there is a hearing before the entire commission. Mm-hmm.
But that's not what he's suggesting.
But that is not what you're suggesting. That is necessary for
again,
this to
I'm
happen.
Open to the mechanism. I'm just wondering on the basic principle, can we provide an outlet?
Yeah, I guess my question would be, has the respondent in that case been given an opportunity to put on a defense before it goes to court, as the respondent would if there is a hearing before the commission?
Mm-hmm. So, Kristen, yours goes to the finding,
yes.
To a finding, and then that's after that it's future.
Yes.
And in the future, it would then go before a public hearing to the Human Rights Commission. Mm-hmm. Is that still confidential at that point? I mean, at what point does it go from being confidential to public?
I would say once you have the public hearing
okay.
process.
I guess what word public means. confidential. So that's not, okay. Yeah. So at that point, it becomes public, which is a potential threat.
Well, the finding itself is a public thing.
Oh, so the finding is public?
Well,
so
I mean,
that's the point at which it becomes public.
I mean, I assume so, because you're issuing the finding.
You know, again, something going public is in and of itself, I would assume, threatening.
In some cases, with the finding, there's an opportunity for the two parties to sit down. And even the agreement, if an agreement is reached, a lot of times that does not become public knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right. So we don't know whether the finding, they haven't agreed. And so, therefore, there's a further investigation and there's a finding.
Right. So a finding doesn't necessarily mean that's going to become public. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what I was trying to say.
Okay. I would just like to add, though, too, that in Ms. Zako's ordinance, because there is the future enforcement mechanism, it's also a big stick as well. There is a built-in incentive for employers, property owners to respond in a much more collaborative manner before it becomes an enforcement mechanism. And that, I think, is kind of the wisdom of it, that the director has a more robust investigation role than in the original Ellis plan and does allow to move on to mediation, which was in our repeated discussions over the last 3 months, it was the opportunity to have the mediation, which was what was really critically important because that was where most cases mm-hmm. they ended. And it was also the rationale for saying why we didn't need to have it wouldn't be that expensive because they would never go to court. So it's an interesting kind of twist that people are talking about making this the vehicle to get people to court when we all admit that that wasn't the big kind of outcome. It was going to be the achieving the mediation born out of investigation. And if you could resolve it before it got to court, that was the ideal. And we still have, again, the big stick in the future if in our recordings and our intake we find that they're actually over half of the mediations fail.
Well, but that's not a threat to the person who's being charged because their case will be over before any future, you know, likelihood.
It does do is it, and you're right, it isn't a big stick. It's a small stick. You know, it's public shaming, really, and it's saying on behalf of our community that this is not okay. We believe that this is a violation of our local law. What I would hope would happen is that with the finding like that, you know, one can sue or take you know, take these things to court, because it is a violation of state and federal law as well. And with a finding like that, I think that a person who had the complaint would have some confidence, and their attorney would have some confidence that they would prevail, and that the business or the institution against whom they were bringing that case would probably have some confidence that they would lose. And I think that when we see, you know, one of the things that I felt was going on before, when all we really had, it seemed, the votes for was only the community piece without any enforcement or investigation. The idea was that we needed time to know, and I felt that I knew, but I think that we don't have the data to show what the incidence of serious violations are in this community. And this is a way to gather that data, and I think we can gather it quickly. And I think if we go ahead and look for the ability to add enforcement when we feel we need it, that we'll be able to use this as a transitional period.
The sort of, from where you've stopped in your proposal, the fact finding, where it's still not public, it's still private, that adding one more step would be going from public or from private to public.
I don't
in
think
the public
it's private
here.
Or public. I think it's more a penalty or not a penalty.
Well, the from what we're our discussion right now, though, that's one of the sticks is,
but a finding
public,
could be
going
public.
Yeah. So the tweak to a little bit more stick would be to go to the public hearing point.
I would personally think that making the record public would be some kind of punishment, some degree. I'm not objective making the record public, but not going to litigation.
But not what?
Not going to litigation. Ourselves.
So is that a good thing or a bad thing? In your mind?
I think it's a good thing to going public information so that people know.
But I think the matter at hand, Mayor Hoosier, is whether or not there is the need for the Human Rights Commission at this point to be the panel that does that decision making. And the amendment at hand is where the director is making that call.
Yes.
I guess.
And that is the
but.
The,
and I don't see a need. I mean, if you're asking about the attorney, I'm just hearing the attorney's question. I'm trying to get back to my answer to your question, which is still hanging there. If for the attorney to feel that he would need to have that public hearing first, where both sides bring all their evidence forward, to me that seems like a kind of a waste of everybody's time and money if we can't do the final enforcement at the end of it. And so I would keep those together, whether they're present or future, rather than take that one piece out separately.
So you wouldn't stop. If you were going to go farther, you wouldn't just stop.
I would go all the way.
Hearing. You'd go, just go for it. Yeah, I mean, do always keeping in mind, and then the chances, the percentage of cases that go to each of these points really dramatically drops. So it's, mm-hmm. you know, all of the threats of time to, you know, spent by our public, Human Rights Commission and the money involved with litigation, that they're really all pretty unlikely.
Let me say that I'm quite comfortable with the proposal which Ms. Sakos has amended. I'm really willing to vote for it today.
Did you finish?
No, I'm just starting. So, so I'm just wondering, just sort of conceptually, are there any other categories of law? You know, we're talking about passing a local law here, a local ordinance, and are there any other categories of local ordinances where if somebody violates that ordinance, it's on the citizen who's been wronged to pursue legal recourse on their own dime. In other words,
this is the case of all the zoning cases. You can take the circuit court if you wish. Citizens are taking.
Well, that's why I'm asking. I mean, what are the precedents for that? I mean, we're talking about creating a law and saying if somebody breaks the law, it's on the person who's been discriminated against, on the person who's been subject of illegal action to pursue legal recourse. And that it rubs me the wrong way. So, I mean, Mr. Brown, do you have any thoughts on that?
The first one that comes to mind is barking dogs.
barking dogs.
Yeah, we have an ordinance that's subject solely to private enforcement. And I don't mean to be frivolous by citing that as an example. That's certainly not at the same level as this, but that's the first thing that comes to mind. Mm-hmm.
So, again, Ms. Sakas, I guess the question is, if we're talking about a category of, let's say in the case of workplace discrimination, a category of employees, if they don't work for an employer that has 15 or more employees and can get recourse through EEOC, hypothetically, and they are denied a job based on the color of their skin, all the evidence indicates they were denied that job based on the color of their skin, we're basically saying to them, you're on your own. I mean, we'll you know, offer mediation and try to come up with a resolution, but if the employer doesn't willingly go along with this, you're on your own. And I'm not sure that's the signal we should be sending to the community to say, in those very few, hopefully, you know, very few cases a year, if any, where we find evidence of clear evidence of egregious violations of anti-discrimination laws, that we should be telling people they're on their own. And I'm wondering if there is any mechanism, even if it's short of what's spelled out here under future enforcement authority, any mechanism where we can send a different kind of signal. And I'm not sure exactly what that looks like, but that would ease
my
conscience.
I do have a question. Doesn't that, having the finding of violation, then give more credence to filing a claim in the Attorney General's office?
Gives it more credence with
the Division of Human Rights and the Attorney General, because then that goes into, that can get into a litigious situation, correct?
It could. I think the advantage under that scenario would be that the investigative work would be done, and if the complainant chose to file a complaint at the state level, they could do so with the results of that investigation, presumably with evidence that had been generated that supports their claim. I don't think the state Division of Human Rights would simply defer to whatever finding has been made locally and take it from there. I think they would have to start the process over.
So I'm guessing that in a non-legally binding way, it's sort of like a true bill or an indictment, that the trial still has to happen with new evidence, but it says that we believe that there's a preponderance of evidence that would support the fact.
And they may want to do their own investigation. Yeah. I just don't know. I don't think there's any model or precedent for this type of situation that we could look at.
I guess I've been looking at this as, from the perspective of someone who might be discriminated against, as the mother of people who are more likely to be discriminated against. That I think that what people need to understand is that when we, if we're going to have an ordinance at all, it needs to be an ordinance that we mean. I would love to see us spend the money that we would need to do full enforcement. I think under $180,000, as Mr. Norris has pointed out, that you wouldn't support full enforcement with that budget because it would all go toward enforcement.
I disagree. I think the numbers that came forward apply to those few cases a year, when you're talking about $3,000 or $4,000 a case, apply to those few cases a year that aren't resolved through mediation, which everybody has pointed out are in the, you know, in Prince William County, for instance, last year they didn't end up taking a single case to court. Mm-hmm. There were only 30 cases out of 598 initial claims that even went to mediation. So I'm fully confident that we can have a robust local enforcement program for well under $100,000 a year. I mean, I don't see any evidence to indicate otherwise. So.
And I would support Ms. Turner's suggestion, which is that we allocate part of those funds toward the funds we would need to both contract out whatever pieces we need to contract out and any enforcement, on the assumption that those costs that are going to be greater, which will be the enforcement pieces, will be few and far between, if any, in a city our size, particularly when we're talking about city businesses only fewer than half of which even apply to state and federal cases. Fewer than half of our businesses have enough employees and fewer than a quarter of them have enough for the EEOC. So it's, you know, we really keep narrowing the field, and to even compare it to Prince William County, which is so much bigger, and, you know, the likelihood, but you don't, you know, I don't believe in giving a blank check either. So I'd say, you know.
You're just making an argument as to why we don't need a large local enforcement mechanism, because we're a very small jurisdiction. We don't have many employers. And what this is doing is the fact of the matter is we don't have the data for our locality.
But we will.
And that we will with an ordinance that does provide us with the means to really do careful intake and recording.
And I don't think that's an argument against having an enforcement piece. I think it's if anything, it's not as big a financial threat as is being put out there. I mean, I understand that it could, in fact, be costly should it happen. But and that's why you put a limit on it. We're not going to give a blank check. Let's, you know, we have $180,000 if we had a director and a half. You know, what does that leave us? $40,000?
Well, Councillor Smith, I must say that I'm surprised to be sitting here in this position, because when we talked at the last council meeting, and then when I talked to you last week, you did not support enforcement at all because you were worried that it would only affect city businesses, and you weren't prepared to support enforcement, which is why I went through all the effort to do this. So I'm surprised to hear that over there.
Yeah, I didn't frame it actually as not supporting enforcement as much as you're right. I've been all along concerned about city residents not benefiting from this, but I kind of got over that after reading your...
Well, and it's also because of the... I have also had that issue with the fact that, you know, when 30% of our employees live here and the rest don't, that this was investing in a local enforcement mechanism that did not give us any information as to where these folks were living and whether they were our constituents or not was also problematic to me. And now, again, this is an opportunity to address. I had even asked about whether or not this service could be provided for city residents, that would be a way to really make sure that it was going to be honed into our constituents' needs. So I don't know if there's any feeling on council for that. I don't want to lard this with any more additional amendments other than a few here and there, because I think it is a pretty significant amendment to the original ordinance that Mr. Ellis put together. And there's a clarity to it that is also clearly making the director more like that advocate, more like that ombudsman, but it's also then has the Human Rights Commission acting in the role of educator and researcher and conciliator, which again, as the language in Mr. Ellis's original ordinance, I found compelling that the first year or so we were going to be working on making those relationships between businesses, between employees, between landlords, between tenants, much more of an honest dialogue and much more greater understanding between all the parties involved. And I believe that Ms. Zekos adds that added layer of attention to detail to get people some sense of closure about their complaint without quashing both the spirit and the resources to handle the other work of the commission, which is, again, doing the research on systematic issues as well as building the foundations for a much more collaborative community.
Could you, Mr. Brown or Mr. Ellis, could you envision, if we don't have three votes for doing the full sort of enforcement authority as authorized by state law, could you envision a scenario in which we create a fund enter into a contractual agreement with an organization that would provide support for individuals where in cases where satisfactory resolution was not achieved through mediation to be able to pursue legal remedies in the courts? Where, in other words, where we are not doing that in-house, We're not taking on the case legally, but we are supporting individuals because we believe it's important. And in many cases, these are going to be people who can't afford to go and hire their own attorneys.
How does that differ from your proposal?
I'm saying take Mistakis's amended version and just add one more section to it, which basically creates a fund. I agree with Ms. Smith that, you know, we can fully staff the other pieces of this commission with $140,000 roughly, which would leave $40,000 that, you know, to set aside in a fund to provide legal assistance to individuals where they're in the determination of the director, maybe in conjunction, you know, in consultation with the city attorney or city council, that there is assistance provided in pursuing legal remedies.
And when you say $140,000, where are you getting that figure?
So if you have a 1.5 FTEs.
But if we had 1.5 FTEs with just public education, if we have what, 1.5, I'm convinced we need at least one full employee doing this. Because most of this is the intake, the dealing with people, the building relationships with the EEOC, making sure that those cases proceed, making sure that people are kind of helped through. If somebody comes and their case was not unlawful discrimination, and yet they still need to figure out what happened, to work with them to try to figure out what other services they need. I don't want to lowball those services that we're providing under this.
Keep in mind that, you know, when we started taking discrimination complaints, we got 28 in 1 year.
But we weren't offering anything.
No, but I'm saying at the high end, we had 55 through EEOCs.
Right, correct.
So, and many of those cases will not even get past intakes. I really don't see it. If we're not doing the enforcement piece, if we're simply doing some basic fact-finding and for a percentage of them doing some mediation, I don't see where that justifies a full-time.
I wonder if a way to approach it might be instead to say to keep this in the future, but to have that be a trigger. That if there's a case, I don't know if we can do that, if there's a case that is not resolved through all of this, then we'll consider whether we need to add enforcement.
Well, can I just get an answer to my question?
A couple of concerns. I'm not sure our enabling legislation goes that far to authorize the retention of outside counsel for a private party. A more practical consideration, though, is if someone has gone through the procedure as outlined in Zacus, and there is a finding of violation, I suspect that person will be able to find an attorney to represent them without any upfront expenditure of funds. I think attorneys take that on a contingency basis, although I should defer to someone who's in private practice.
That's mostly true.
Okay. So again,
I mean that would be an advantage.
So that
having
would
finding.
Give them that presumption that it's likely.
Can I talk a little bit about the funding? When we were putting together the $180,000, it was for two personnel, two staff members, but also we were building into that some funding for the other pieces that we've talked about, education and pursuing the institutional side. So that 180 is not just two people. It's two people and operating costs to help the commission as well. So just wanted to remind folks of that because we're focusing on those two positions.
Other comments or questions? Is there a motion?
Well, I mean, are we really ready for a motion yet? I don't know how we get past, if even under Ms. Sakis's proposal, we need money to contract with outside services for this niche that is not EEOC, but
I'm picturing
eligible.
Hiring somebody who's capable of doing this, somebody with a paralegal background or who has some experience in civil rights law.
But you can't, I mean, what we're told is that the investigator can't be the mediator.
Well, but I think what we're saying, though, is the budget is $180,000. And so if there is mediation, I mean, that would have to go outside mediation, that would have to come out of that budget.
Well, because that's what I'm asking.
But then
so, you know, if we could define what that is, it would give us at least a better sense for...
After a year, you'll find out how much of that will be needed.
So, you know, I don't think it's going to be, what's $100,000? I mean...
And it may be that the other staff person is the mediator.
Or, you know, again, it's going to be up to the discretion of the director to hire his or her staff. And as this is implemented across the course of the year, the understanding of the workload and need for mediation become apparent. And it might very well be that there is going to be only a half FTE committed to, helping to set up the dialogue on race functions, for instance. But then the balance could be used for a mediation fund for outside disinterested third party. I do think that because this wasn't really, because we're talking about this fresh, I would feel more comfortable not having any different budget arrangements with this amendment, because if we are adding to this budget, it makes it something that the public needs to really understand more fully.
So are you saying the limit of the budget for everything is 180, and after that, what happens? I mean, what if there isn't money after hiring people and education? I mean, you have to be somewhat confident that there is enough money budgeted to do what you say you're going to do, which is, if it's this proposal, then you are most likely talking about contracting out some of those services.
I have a suggestion, which is that we pass this as it is with maybe some tweaks, but basically this, and that we have a series of public meetings where we ask people to come and talk to us about implementation of what that looks like. And if we feel that, you know, after those meetings, that there is need for another budget thing, that would, you know, we've heard a lot of people saying, stop, don't do anything now. This is all different. We don't know what this is. I think that the way that we can move forward now is if it's not that different, if it's not another budget item. But I think that if we come out of those public meetings with the conviction that we need to apply more money to a program within this commission or within this department, that we do that separately, that we add that.
I think the town halls would be a good vehicle for that.
It may be, but, you know, I would support more enforcement, Kristen, if you...
No, I agree.
I would support more enforcement.
A lot more money, and I'm not sure we can do that without another public...
I disagree that enforcement would cost a lot more money. There is no evidence to say that...
Well, what you're talking about enforcement is paying lawyers to go to court. I mean, that's what...
What do you mean there's no evidence?
That's why you put a limit. Quite frankly, I don't think that's true. But so that's why you
allocate... So what do you mean by enforcement? Because to me,
I don't think it's going to happen. There is no evidence.
I suspect it probably will.
You know, we were given research papers on exactly this question.
Even staff has looked at talking to three or four other jurisdictions. There is a cost.
There are studies on this. We were given these papers.
No, I see where you're coming from. What I'm saying is
that... we're tiny, so even the percentages
get like...
To commit
to something that we don't have in our budget. And it may be that those meetings will find that it wouldn't cost money. I'm totally open to having that, and it's in here now.
I'm just saying, I sort of calling your bluff a little bit. I mean, After all the research, after all the meetings, after all of the information that we've been given, I'm confident, particularly with a fund of money that we can establish as a limit so that we're not just writing a blank check.
So what happens to the person who is told, if you go through this process, we'll have your back, we'll take you to court, and whoops, sorry, we passed our limit, we can't. Is that what happens?
Well, that's why it goes through City Council. And that's the checks and balances. I think there's a lot of checks and balances in here. The director is a check. The Human Rights Commission is a check. The City Council is a check, to be sure. And if you had a case that made it through all those checks, I would bet City Council would say, it's so egregious that we should back this.
It seems to me that we have been having some discussion as to what City Councils will do. Is there a motion to discuss, or do we just keep on talking?
Well, it sounds to me, I mean, are you making a motion that we adopt
this unamended original version without the word future?
That's a good question. Gosh, I'd have to go back and look. How does that work?
Because you were not 2 weeks ago. You were very much against it 2 weeks
ago. And again, I would...
As to both of you.
The cost estimates that we were given for doing that was reflective of the ordinance Mr. Norris put forth. And what I heard, and we have staff, it's, I mean, the discussion here is basically saying that staff doesn't know what they're doing. We got information from our staff, our city manager and assistant city manager, that said that it was going to cost around $160,000 for the Norris ordinance. Then you add $180,000 on top of that for the dialogue
Ms.
on Galvin, race
that's
functions.
Absolutely
and
inaccurate.
That's $350,000.
No, no. That's
neither Mr. Jones nor Mr. Ellis ever said that. Never. What they said was that for cases that require in full, in-depth investigation, they may run as high as $4,000 plus mediation
costs. They gave
costs.
Unit
is that accurate?
That's correct, yes.
And did you ever say that How you expect 100% of the cases that require full, in-depth investigation?
No, I will say that in terms of our baseline, I think the EEOC numbers of the number of 55 cases from FY11 provides us a good baseline. Those are 55 cases that were actually investigated.
This was page 5 of the staff memo. There were 55 cases from Seville reported to the EEOC in 2011. If roughly half of those cases were fully investigated, 8 dismissed, and the rest sent to mediation, 20, the estimated cost for an independent third party would be approximately $160,000.
That's correct. We said if that was
if.
The case.
Right. If.
What we have learned is that of the 55 cases that were brought to EEOC in 2011, not one of them was mediated or dismissed. All of them were investigated on some level by the EEOC.
And what we know from real-world experience is that in Prince William County, which has had an active ongoing Human Rights Commission for many years now, is that the vast majority of those cases never even see mediation. Forget about full in-depth investigation. Forget about court action. 598 cases initiated or complaints.
598 inquiries/
complaints. Out of that, 130 actually made it past the intake stage. And out of those, only 30 ended up being mediated. So we're talking about a tiny handful each year that will likely incur, you know, a few thousand dollars in costs. And so, and I suspect that if we have cases like this, they will indeed be pretty egregious. And again, I go back to my original question, which is, how do we tell a citizen of our community that if they've been the victim of egregious, you know, what appears through all the system of checks and balances to be egregious discrimination, how do we, in good conscience, tell them they're on their own when it comes to taking and seeking legal remedy for that? For somebody violating our own ordinance to their detriment.
Well, let me offer something here, which I know is going to upset some people and please other people. Recognition that there are going to be people who are worried about this and that it frightens. But I think sometimes, just like like all major legislation about human rights causes a lot of turmoil, I would renew my motion that I made 2 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, whenever it was that we first had this, I would use this version that we're talking about with the Kristen Sakis on it and take out the word future.
I do not see that we have had the data to do that. It was never clear to us through the report from the study commission. That commission's was basically a hung jury, 4 against, 1 abstained. And it was clearly a situation that there is a lot of disagreement in the community about what is the appropriate tack to take in terms of the local enforcement mechanism. I thought what you proposed tonight, Ms. Zekos, was extremely balanced. And it was addressing the needs of every component of this community. And I think as counselors, that is our job. We have to look at the entire community. I could not support the original pending version with the future mechanism present. And if that is a situation
then I'm on record saying that I do believe that we need to be working more and more in the direction of building relationships with our business community, building trust between members of our community, understanding that there are multiple obstacles to employment besides discrimination. They have an awful lot to do with education, adult workforce training, daycare, transportation. I realize that is not the sentiment of the group that's been pushing for this for the last year, but it is the sentiment of the group of a lot of people in the community that we need to be working towards solving the problems that have a material impact on our poor families, families living in poverty, not making very unpredictably costly gestures to appease what a handful of people have been saying is the only course of action that we need to take. And I thought that this was a very good compromise, and I would have supported it.
I understand that, and I appreciate that. I have supported full enforcement from the beginning, and I was working very hard to get more than nothing, which is what I was worried would happen if we didn't have support for enforcement. I have seen, and not in the city specifically, but I have seen in my family incidents of racial discrimination. I've certainly seen incidents of racial discrimination in my life, and I think if we're going to have an ordinance that says that it is illegal in this community to discriminate on the basis of race or sex or disability or any of the things that we've said that we believe in, just like I think at the federal level, if we're going to say that these things are illegal, that we should be willing to put our enforcement where our mouth is. And I've said so all along, and I know that this was a more popular compromise, and as good compromises are, and I think it was a good compromise. But I'm not willing to compromise when it's, with the lives of people who are our most vulnerable citizens. And I, what I'm hoping will happen, and I really am convinced of this, or I would not support the position that I'm taking, that for local businesses in Charlottesville, this is a good thing. I'm supporting it because I believe that it's a good thing. I believe that as long as we have a community where we have this wall between us, where people on each side of the wall are convinced the people on the other side hate them, and where the dialogue continues on either side of that wall, oh, I was discriminated against, this happened, but nobody can ever actually look at it and investigate it and determine whether it was indeed a violation of the law, that we continue to run into resentments, we continue to run into rumors, we continue to run into what one of our public comment people said about, businesses on the downtown mall, they discriminate. I don't believe it's true. But I think until we're able to use some sort of mechanism for investigating that and finding that out, that story will continue to be the dominant dialogue in our community. I think that this will, over time, and I think public meetings are a necessity in the next couple of months before we implement anything. And we may not have 3 votes for it. It's only a motion at this point.
What I'd suggest is we read it aloud.
Well, we could do that.
Well, the other alternative would be that this needs to be posted and it needs to have its own hearing.
And what I do not want to have happen tonight is delay. Because I think that to delay it means, two of us are gone next month, or for the first meeting in next month, and I don't think we would do it then. I think that would be another month. We've already delayed over a year on this. I think we need to enact something tonight. I would be, I had said at one point that I would be willing to put this forward and then amend it later if it's a budget issue. So
just to clarify, your suggestion is to still utilize EEOC for EEOC cases, use PHA for fair housing cases. This enforcement authority would only apply to cases that aren't.
Well, I withdraw my motion because
–
Yeah, because that's not what the original one was. And I think that the original one costs a lot more.
Well, no, I'm saying, I thought you were saying take the
model.
Because
they don't provide the same sort of enforcement. So it does do something different to our smaller businesses than to our larger businesses. Frankly, Ms. Smith, this is such a surprise to me that you're taking this position that I'm a little flustered.
So what part of EEOC does not go to court? Ever?
I'm totally confused at this point. Which ordinance are we looking at?
I'm not sure what your question is.
Why isn't the EEOC have enforcement?
What does the EEOC do when it finishes? Finds a violation.
The EEOC issues what's called a right to sue letter. Mm-hmm. And they will issue that regardless of whether they believe the case has merit or not, because that's the complainant's ticket to get into federal court. And you heard statements here tonight from the public that EEOC very, very rarely goes to court on behalf of a single individual. I don't have personal knowledge of that, but I tend to think that's correct, that EEOC intervenes in court more often in cases where there is a class of individuals who have been discriminated against. But the EEOC takes the complaint under a variety of federal discrimination statutes. They try mediation, they do investigation, and they attempt to get a resolution. And if they don't, or if they don't think the cause has merit, they will issue what's called a right to sue letter. And again, it is up to the individual at that point to retain counsel and to go into federal court and seek redress.
And if the case is strong and verified through the discrimination, the prior attorney will take the case and then it will proceed.
Yes, or if the case is very strong, the respondent has real incentive to reach a resolution through mediation, although that certainly does not always happen because there are plenty of federal court discrimination cases.
What attracted me about your original proposal, Ms. Sekos, was that it did provide some help to mediation. Most, also 99% of the cases will be taken care of. Mm-hmm. Very little we left to be done by private attorneys. To me, that still is a good solution. And we have taken care of most of the people right away, or 99 or more. Well, so I would be happy to support the original proposal, even to the extent of putting some money for attorneys, but not to change.
And I would be willing to, given that we had that estimate, I believe it was $190 per hour, mm-hmm. average of 12. Right. Per case, mediation case, I did. If you do apply the ratios of the Prince William percentage of mediations, given the investigations they do, it was like only 5% of what was taken in, and so that translated to 3 mediations for Charlottesville. If we applied that to some of the cases that we've had, the 28 to 55, right. So I would be willing to add an additional item to that degree of to deal with 3 mediations for the first year using your unit costs. But it would be relative to make sure that we had the director's robust kind of job description that is in the amended version that Ms. Sekos gave us. So that would be the director with investigative and mediation. With, you know, so it would be $180,000 plus. I can't imagine that being more than, what, $10,000?
You limit on the number of mediations?
Well, you're budgeting, right? You're
right.
Trying to figure out. So I'm trying to anticipate what we would be projecting.
Well, then
because you keep saying on the one hand that there's not much by way of a problem, and on the other hand, when you try to put a dollar figure on it, you say that's too expensive.
No.
I'm trying to figure out how can we budget for this? How can we budget for this?
Yeah.
And so I was just trying to use those ratios of mediations relative to intake that we saw in Prince William.
So how much money are you talking about?
It's like $2,200 per mediation based on a 190 so times 12.
We're talking about $6,600 we're committing to mediations, to this, to the city's role in
to add
this,
to the 180.
That's ridiculously low.
Well, I don't. I'm still absolutely utterly convinced that we can have a fully effective enforcement program for. You know, if we have a full-time director who's working on the education and systemic piece, that, and that's, let's say, $100,000, including benefits and everything, that frees up $80,000 for other pieces, and some of that's programmatic costs. But if you look at what Prince William County spends on their overall enforcement program, which is 300 some odd thousand a year, to process 600 inquiries, and again, not all 600 end up becoming cases, but whereas we had 55 inquiries or 28 inquiries, or, I mean, it's a much smaller universe here.
But once again, there needs to be a clarification because there are 55 cases, not just inquiries. In Prince William County, an inquiry could be a phone call, and that could be an inquiry. It's not a case. So that's why we just need to be careful about confusing inquiries versus phone calls. And as I mentioned in my memo, a lot of it is guesswork. I mean, until we know how many people would actually come to the city and ask for this type of assistance, we're just not sure.
Yeah.
And can we, another clarification from Mr. Brown. So the difference between the state and the federal criteria for illegal discrimination is... I know there's 6 to 14 employees for discharge, for employment discharge. I read that piece.
State statute.
Is there any other difference? Is the 6 to 14 or some, I know that the different arenas have different numbers of employees. Does it differ by in any other arena?
EEOC administers not only the what I would call the basic prohibition against employment discrimination. It's
right.
called Title VII.
Right.
It also handles things such as the Equal Pay Act and age discrimination in employment and a whole variety of non-discrimination.
Gender.
And they have different thresholds in terms of the number of employees.
Right.
The Equal Pay Act applies to all employers who are covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act. That's virtually everyone.
And who adjudicates that?
Excuse me?
Does EEOC do that?
The Equal Pay Act is, they do, but it's a little bit different because that is one of the statutes where if you want, you can go directly to court.
But could EEOC. We, if somebody came in with that complaint, would we send them to EEOC?
Yes.
Okay. So the only question, the reason I bring that up is that we were talking about taking on all the cases that EEOC and PHA
don't.
And really, what does it leave? It does leave some of the ones that we talked about, credit and things. But they were not the bulk of the charges that we saw.
Correct.
So, I mean, we're really talking. And then if we're going to take on the state's difference, it sounds like we're really talking about a slice of employment discrimination that involves being, you know, losing your job, basically. But not all those other... Those other criteria.
And one other further kind of complicating factor, and this is something you pointed out, Councillor Smith, and that is this working arrangement between the state, what was the State Council on Human Rights, and the EEOC, where they take each other's complaints. In other words, if an employment discrimination case is submitted to the state, it may be outside the scope of state law, but they can accept it if it's otherwise within EEOC's jurisdiction. And that's that working arrangement, which you sent out a link on that you pointed out.
Right.
So. I think one of the challenges in terms of not knowing is you know, it's kind of known that EEOC will deal with employers that have 15 or more. So we've got a handle on that. The question is folks who work for businesses with less than that, there hasn't been an option potentially before. And so we don't know. If you know, put that option out there, it could be 5, it could be 10, it could be a number of individuals.
But the law doesn't protect for necessarily for. I mean, where in the state and federal laws is there even legal protection for businesses of that size?
State, my understanding, the state, you can't go below six employees.
But six for discharge.
Discharge.
Discharge. It's a very small slice. Mm-hmm. And so if there really aren't legal remedies, we're not talking about those people. It's a shame and horrible if they don't have legal remedies. Mm. But the arena that we're talking about funding here, if we're talking about contracting out mediation or whatever it is we're talking about doing, is just a small window of what otherwise we will send to the EEOC and to PHA. So it's really just
well,
not that big a universe.
Is that it's businesses between 5 and 14 for hiring, right, as well?
No.
No? What happens to them?
I don't think there is any existing state remedy.
Well, that's what I mean. So we would be covering those.
No, well, we no, can't.
We cannot create a remedy locally that does not already exist at the state or federal level.
We can't make up laws.
And the state forbids discrimination in hiring for?
No.
At all?
The state statute or employment discrimination applies to discharges
only
of that window of individuals between, is it 5 and 15 or 6
it's
and 15?
It's 6 and 14 that six isn't, 14. Yeah, before it's covered by EEOC.
So it is totally more legal to discriminate on the basis of race, sex, in the state of Virginia.
And
you just can't
federal.
Let anybody.
Well, it's the
so
federal
discharge
government.
Means letting people go.
Right.
Yeah, so you
just
can't
never hire
let
them.
Anybody go based on those reasons. And that's the way it is.
So we, you know, this whole arm of the Human Rights Commission really is dictated by what the laws say. And it's really the other piece, the institutional piece, and I would hope that the director, as he or she hears cases that, quite frankly, do not fit under the state and federal laws, would perhaps give them an avenue through the Human Rights Commission to just, you know, not necessarily hear their case, but to take that information. That would
but,
be part
then,
of the information.
And what is the purpose of having the Human Rights Commission hearing panel for cases that have no basis in state law?
Well, they wouldn't. They
so
wouldn't.
Then why it doesn't the original amended version that Ms. Zacos presented applicable?
It is
seems
only
to be appropriate.
It's only applicable to those cases that fall under state and federal law.
Or cases of credit or cases of
non-employment, non-fair housing that under your version are referred to EEOC or PHA. For example, if someone who worked for an employer with less than 15 employees is fired, that case would not get referred but would be handled locally.
And there's there's 490 businesses that fall into that particular niche. But really what we're doing by offering services for credit and for public accommodation and things is then we're solving a lot of the problems that I had, which is that those are much more directed towards city residents. I mean, city residents are you know, we would only serve city residents under those violations. I suppose you could come up with a scenario where we wouldn't, but the arena that we're even talking about accommodating is really quite narrow. It fills a void.
I have a question because I have imagined that if somebody had a problem with, say, credit at a bank in Charlottesville, that if it's against the law to discriminate on the basis of race in the city of Charlottesville, that the violation occurred within the city of Charlottesville, no matter where the person is from.
And it could be. I don't know. For banks, you know, where's the bank?
No, I don't mean where the bank is from. I mean where the person bringing the complaint is from.
Right, but who are they complaining against?
Yeah, the bank's corporate headquarters is
but
in
if the discrimination happened here. Right.
Yeah, and that's a question I don't know.
That's
Mr. Brown, do you know the answer to that?
Is it the corporate headquarters?
Is it the
local?
Right.
But in that case, that would be an EEOC. No, that's only employment.
No.
Yeah.
And the bigger corporations have the ability to absorb lawsuits, quite frankly. It is the small companies that have a very small margin of error in their profit margins that are going to be the ones that will immediately be hiring their own attorneys and trying to get their own defense. And so I think there's that implication as well. And
what do you mean hiring their own attorneys?
Because if they're going to be facing a situation where they've been accused and they're being brought in, I think immediately they're going to be seeking legal counsel because of the nature of this being tied to the local enforcement mechanism right now. And so you're dealing with, and I would like to point out that I think that we're not only talking about businesses that are owned by white people. I mean, we have a growing minority population that's owning businesses as well. So I just want to lay it out there that we're working very, very hard to create a diverse economic system with a lot more minority and female-owned businesses. So they're always the very small ones, very, very narrow profit margins. And so they will be incurring legal costs as well, which is interesting. We're not talking about trying to assist the small businesses in these kinds of additional costs, but I did want to point that out, that this will be a hardship.
And just in terms of the credit, we did get some feedback from one of the Northern Virginia Human Rights Directors that they're few and far in between, but they can be very time intensive in terms of, particularly if you're dealing with a large bank or something like that, that's going to take a while to get to who you need to get to, and then the volumes of paperwork. Mm-hmm.
And we can't have subpoena powers, or we can?
What's that?
Can we have subpoena powers? That was, I know, one of the questions that came up.
And this was from an organization that actually has subpoena powers.
But under current law?
Yeah, during the hearing stage.
During the hearing stage, yeah. Okay.
So I want to make a comment about getting back to Ms. Sakis' proposal, because I actually think there are aspects of your proposal which really were, I think, a compromise that I think could help bring people on both sides together on, which is, you know, you had the one sort of one group saying we need the local Human Rights Commission to hear all cases, and the other group saying we don't want a Human Rights Commission hearing any cases. And I think what you were trying to do with your proposal, at least the one part of your proposal, was to say, well, let's take advantage of the resources, the state and federal resources, mm-hmm. the EEOC, PHA, et cetera, but at least provide an outlet for cases that aren't covered through those resources. And so I hope you would be willing to consider a sort of a modification of that, which says that for those cases that aren't covered by EEOC or aren't covered under existing resources, that we will provide the enforcement authority. And again, I think in on a day-to-day or on a year-to-year basis, we're talking about a tiny number of cases that, but at least to have that outlet in place, I think is a compromise that's worthy of support.
Just two comments I want to make. I know you guys have a fair amount of comments. One, that when initially Mr. Norris talked about the proposal and not having enforcement because of institutional issues, I still think it's a valid point, even though you changed your positions a little bit since last time. Second,
since 2 months ago, yeah. I haven't changed it since the last meeting, but yeah.
It was recent, not too long ago. Anyway, you're right to change minds anytime you like. Other question which my concern is a more procedural concern, which I think I raised that to Ms. Sekos even today, this afternoon, that her proposal, we had a public hearing today and nobody had seen the proposal till basically today. It was on a website. I saw it in writing today at 6 o'clock. And there's a public hearing. I'm just worried that it is the right way to have a public hearing. Somebody, when public has not even seen the proposal, in writing at least, in hard copy form, anywhere. And I'm not sure how we can act fully, and I had talked about the possibility of having a first reading and then a second reading when she comes back.
Well, that's an idea.
So,
but may I ask, what are we going to be having a first reading on?
I don't know. There's no motion on the floor.
But I mean, is it Ms. Zeko's amended version of the pending version as is, or were there amendments made to the amendment? I'm not sure.
I was talking about the original proposal that she had.
And, you know,
that was the amended pending.
Yes.
Well, for the purposes of argument or discussion or moving this forward, I would like to make a motion that we approve Ms. Sakis's pending version. I have a couple of sort of wording changes, but we can discuss those in a minute. And removing the word future under enforcement authority for those small number of cases each year that don't fall under all the other categories we've discussed. So.
Well, I'll second that, at least for the sake of conversation. I'd still wonder whether we should, I know it's only, but read it out loud, since some of the words were changed and for the sake of the public.
I would actually go along with Mr. Hooch's suggestion that we consider that a motion and a second on a first reading, because it is significantly different than what I brought forward today.
Absolutely.
Even though it's only one word, and I'd be happy to read it out loud.
Can we
do that?
What I would suggest is that you have a motion and second and vote on substituting this version for the version that is now pending on first reading, and then you could have the second reading, final reading, whenever you want to schedule it.
I'm sorry. So we're amending, though, Ms. Sakos's version to remove the word future.
Well, it's not being amended. That was Councillor Norris's motion. Because this is this
we have
is
one
not,
already on the table, which is the original.
The
version.
One that's on the table was the one in your notebook called pending version. So,
right, he's making a motion that we amend that.
What I would suggest that
to this.
Mr. Norris move is that the Kristen Zekas version be substitute with Kristen Zekas version, absent the reference to future enforcement, be substituted for the version that is pending on first reading.
So moved.
But is that a first reading or a second reading?
This would be if the motion passes. You would still need to have at some point a second and final reading.
Right. Okay. So I would second that.
Do we need to include all enforcement? Right now.
Can I just a couple of points of clarification?
Well, Ms. Smith. Just ask the question, do I need to withdraw my motion from 5 minutes ago?
Can I back up here? Because the public is understanding, based on what was posted on the agenda on the website, was that the pending was the version that did not have a local enforcement mechanism.
It had it as a future mechanism.
But that it was future, but that the alternate was the one that had the local enforcement mechanism now. So and then the version that Ms. Zekos brought forward to us broke off some part of the alternate version, put it in the present, and kept two other parts of the future. So I am very confused now as to why we're just changing the pending ordinance into Kristen and Ms. Zekos' version with the future removed, which completely obliterates the integrity of that first pending motion, ordinance, which I could support.
Actually, should we vote on?
We should vote
on the original one.
Yes,
and some of us might vote. We might vote it down.
It sounds
and then
like
have a new motion.
Mr. Brown was suggesting that we need to vote on Mr. Norris's substitution of this for that, which is exactly what you're saying. So it would. We'll have a vote today, right now.
Which would have the effect of obliterating.
Of whether,
but I would. I am saying I would like to have the ability to vote for one of these ordinances, and be on record as supporting a human rights commission. I simply do not agree with this tactic.
Okay, I withdraw my motion, and if you want to move to on second
the
reading
unamended
to approve the
version.
Unamended,
yes. Okay.
Go ahead.
I
agree.
Which has no enforcement, no investigation, no intake.
And I would have voted for yours.
I understand.
But that is not going to be the one on the table anyway, correct? Am I understanding that? Correct.
So I
wanted to vote
only for study and public education.
And with the future possibility of a local enforcement mechanism. So
okay.
I would like...
That,
Go ahead. Sorry.
Okay, Mr. Bowden.
If we're talking about the what's called the pending version,
yes,
that does not require a motion. That is currently before council. It has been moved and seconded on first reading. If you would like to vote on this, you can call the question.
I call the question on the initial. It was slightly amended with some tweaks, but without these amendments.
You're not talking about your version.
I'm not talking about my version. I'm talking about the version that has no enforcement, no investigation, no intake, no EEOC, and only the public education and dialogue.
Yeah, that was in your notebook, and it contains a number of underlying and strikeouts.
With the idea of future reference.
That reflected council's discussions as recently as March 4th.
Yes.
Right. So,
that's called pending.
It's called pending.
Yes, and you can proceed to a vote on second reading because that has already been moved and seconded.
Okay.
So we're going to be voting on pending motion. Also, please vote.
Oh, I missed. I'm so used to voting on other stuff.
Go again.
Okay, sorry about that.
You voted right, I think.
Yeah, I did. I've always said I opposed it.
Push the wrong button.
What am I doing?
And we need Hooja and Galvin.
You guys can vote again.
Mr. Hooja?
Yeah, I voted already.
No, you got to vote again. That's up.
All right, so Mr. Mayor, I'd like to move that we approve on first reading the version titled Pending Version with Amendments Proposed by Kristen Sakis, striking the word future in section 2-439.1 and 2-439.2.
Which, would you like me to read it out loud?
That's
can I just have a couple of points of clarification? Page 5, section 2-438, would you like to eliminate that section?
Page 5, 438, future enforcement authority? I think just the word future.
No, he's right. That's redundant.
Oh, right. Yeah. Right. Yeah,
that's just
you.
Teeing up the future enforcement.
Okay. Second clarification, as drafted, and this is in paragraph E near the bottom of page 3, you'll recall that after mediation that's not successful, there is a finding of violation. I think there's some inconsistency with page 5, paragraph B, where it talks about if mediation is unsuccessful, the director shall prepare a written summary of the evidence on which the determination of probable cause is based and shall recommend appropriate remedies for the discriminatory actions. So in one, you have this finding of violation, in the other, you don't. So
That's after the determination of probable cause.
In each case, it is after the mediation has failed.
Yes.
Wow. So what do you recommend?
In one case, after the mediation has failed, the investigation is completed. And in the other case, when the mediation has failed, there's a report written right away.
Can we just ask staff on second reading to clean up that version to make it consistent?
Yeah, I don't think you need that finding a violation if it's going on to the commission.
But can you just make sure this is consistent throughout? Towards that end,
should we strike something right now so that when it goes online, it doesn't confuse people?
Yeah, at the bottom of page 3 in E, I would say that the director will either dismiss the complaint as not constituting a violation or proceed pursuant to that section on page 5.
Okay.
Last thing, I don't think you need 2-443, the last section anymore, which talks about the effective date.
2-443.
What page?
Page 8, the very last section, which talks about effective date it will be effective on passage.
And I had a couple other minor wording changes on page 1, section 2-432A. The last 8 words of that paragraph should be stricken. It should have been stricken before.
Oh.
Shall serve at the pleasure of City Council.
Which page?
On page 1.
Yeah. You're right.
I was looking at the other A where the last words were race, color, religion, sex. Sorry.
Shall serve at the pleasure. And then.
Because it's redundant, changes anything.
Yeah. And I would also, under section 2-434 on page 3, under section B, It starts by saying, upon the filing of a complaint alleging an unlawful discriminatory practice, the director shall promptly serve a copy of the complaint on each respondent named therein. I think we should just strike that sentence because, in my mind, if somebody comes in and files a completely frivolous complaint, there's no need to alert, you know, the party that there's been a complaint filed against them.
Well, interview the complainant. If
I would put that requirement down in the next paragraph where it says...
It's already there.
Well, it says the complaint may be dismissed by the director without investigation if it fails to adequately allege a violation or is otherwise deficient on face. And then say if it's not dismissed, a copy of the complaint will be served on the...
But it's already there. It says the written determination shall promptly be served on the parties.
Well, that's the written determination of probable cause. I guess the question is, do you want the complaint served on the respondent before the finding of probable cause or at that time?
Yeah, I wonder that.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. The way you read it is fine.
So we should strike the first sentence of... Oh, no, you were saying...
You can strike the first sentence of B, and then in C provide for service of the complaint on the respondent if it's not initially dismissed as frivolous.
See, I read this language to do that, to say whether or not the director found it to have probable cause.
So in D, it would say if the director determines that there is probable cause to believe a violation has occurred, the director will serve a copy of the complaint on each respondent named therein.
You can do it that way.
And propose an initial meeting between the parties.
You certainly can do it that way. I had actually suggested putting it in C, where it says that it can be dismissed if it fails to adequately allege a violation, and then the next sentence would be, if it is not dismissed, a copy of the complaint would be filed on the respondent.
Right.
And then under section B on that same page, it says... fair rental housing complaints addressed by Piedmont Housing Alliance. I would strike the word rental there. They handle all housing complaints, not just rental. And then it says investigation and enforcement will be conducted by those bodies. First of all, we shouldn't say will be because we don't know if they're going to pursue investigation or enforcement.
Maybe.
And then PHA actually doesn't do enforcement, so we could say they will, enforcement may be initiated or pursued by
conducted
those.
Conducted or initiated by.
Yeah, something like that. So I just want to make sure we're not.
Good.
That's it.
Shall I read it out loud?
I would like to make one modification. Page 4. And it would be in section F. So the
page
sentence,
four,
page four, it would be 2-434F. And then you get on to page 4 in the top paragraph.
Oh, it starts on page 3. Okay, got it.
So the top line says, contract on behalf of the city with any disinterested third party, be it a person, partnership, corporation, or other entity qualified. So it's the inclusion of the phrase disinterested third party, be it
instead of person, partnership, corporation, or other entity.
Right. There is nothing in there.
Or objective, neutral.
Neutral.
Something like that
neutral.
Would be fine, just to make sure that word is in there.
Is that okay with everybody?
Yeah.
I'm wondering, Mr. Brown, on page 1 under 2-431C, since we use the word unlawful discriminatory practice, and given the discussion we had about what we have can and cannot do vis-a-vis state and federal law, if we should just say, as used herein, the term unlawful discriminatory practice includes conduct in violation of Virginia or federal state statute or regulations.
I mean, that would be consistent with the way the state has it stated. So sure.
Any other changes?
over all my various versions. I guess it was going to be, 2433. It'd be page 2.
We don't have page numbers.
It's section 2-433A. And it would say, identify and review policies and practices of the city of Charlottesville and its boards and commissions and other agencies within the city, I would like to say, subject to the review of council.
What do you mean?
Where does that mean?
So that the council is aware of what the commission is identifying, and I would say subject to the review and approval of council, so that we know that it's not being used for any particular cause or...
Well, I wonder if that sort of infringes on their autonomy, though.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's not going to be any oversight on the part of the elected body over this commission to see that there is not going to be any abuse of the use of that commission by any members of this elected body, for example. It's possible.
That's one reason I would want it not to have to go through the city council. But, identify and review
but
policies
subject
and
to
practices.
The review of a supermajority on council. That's okay with me if it's got to be the whole council aware of it.
I think we should be aware of it. I'm not sure. It's just reviewing policies and practices. It's not changing them.
Well, it's identifying those policies and practices and boards and commissions and public agencies that are going to be reviewed and studied. And that was, I do think there should be some oversight or at least input from the elected body on what that is.
I see your point. I'm not sure we have to approve it, but
and the commission reports.
I'm trying to think of some comparable, you know, board or commission.
The commission, yeah. I mean, for instance, when the planning commission comes up with their priorities and their work plan, we don't approve that. We don't have a role in approving the planning commission's priorities or work plan, but we do have a role in appointing the planning commissioners. And if we don't like their priorities, we can always unappoint them when their terms come up.
But
we can look at all their decisions, which we approve.
We can unappoint them for good cause by a majority vote of city council at any time.
I think if we feel like they're flagrantly abusing their position, which I can't imagine they would do, but if they were flagrantly abusing their position, then that would be good cause to remove them.
And I would think it might, Kathy, it might be more how that process happens,
mm-hmm.
too, rather than thinking they're going to go sort of straight to the, whatever.
Well, I'm just having some sort of awareness that you talk about checks and balances. The commission itself needs a check and balance so that it is not abusing its power. And we are the only body there that's able to do that. And we're going to wait at the end of the year? Are we going to be, hypothetically, if this is causing, because there's not protocols in place, there's not an understanding with all the other agencies in the city, and then the commission is just imposing itself to do investigation and demanding documentation, and we have no idea what's going on. We just wait until there's a problem. So that's why I wanted to have some. I thought it would be valuable to know what did they identify as their charge, and did we think that it was in keeping with what we viewed the purpose of the commission to be.
How about under section 244.1, annual report on page 7, maybe we could add a sentence to the effect that, council would vote each year on accepting their work plan, on accepting their annual report.
That would be good. I think
instead of us sort of, instead of them having to run every single thing by us.
I was always thinking it would be a consolidated list.
Yeah. And I think that's what this section envisions, is providing us
The report shall also outline the commission's work plan for the ensuing year, but it doesn't...
For council approval.
For a council approval.
Yeah.
Okay.
Does that get at what you were trying to do, Annie?
Okay. Approval and modification.
Yeah, approval and...
Right.
Or modification.
Right.
Any other comments or changes? Is there a motion on the floor?
Did you make your motion?
So this is, everything's been, all the future's been removed, right? So this is all happening now.
Mr. Brown, what's the protocol? Do I accept all these friendly amendments that were just made?
Yes.
Yeah, I accept all the friendly amendments.
And the second accepts them as well.
So second.
Okay, so...
Accept them. So I don't know if I seconded yet.
When would council like to have your second reading on this?
It would be the second meeting in May.
Second meeting in May. I want to make a comment or two, if I may. I think this change we are adopted in first reading would be very harmful to our community, and not, it would create more problems than solutions in my mind. I think it is a way of abusing certain human rights, not taking care of human rights. I really think that we have done more damage in my mind than good in this way, because I think it will be, this power can be abused, as Kathy said, and I think that is really shameful to do that.
May I make a comment as well? It would have been wonderful if we had had a greater consensus on the direction and the future of the city, and how to work through the very, very painful racial history that we have. But over and over again, be it in the report that we received and the testimony that we've heard, there was always a commingling of what happened in the past, what was being projected for the future, without looking at all of the data that was impacting people's lives in the present. And that, to me, was a recipe for misdiagnosing the illness. And I think we are prescribing the wrong medicine. I think it's almost like... It is not going to be building, or it could very well not build the kinds of working relationships we need to grow the economy that we must have, and the variety of jobs that we have all said that we must have, and the skills that we need to provide for our people in need to become much more successful in this community. So I hope I'm wrong. I will always continue to work to form partnerships, as I constantly do now, between the business community, the educational communities, the low-income communities, to create those opportunities for employment to get people out of poverty. That is, and I'd like to just make another point that people have shared some of their experiences with discrimination. There have been at least three times in my life where I have discovered that, I was not paid what I was worth, and it was related to my gender. I quit each time. The last time I did actually try to pursue an outlet going to the EEOC. It was in Richmond. It was too difficult. I really do think that the solution, working with a local chapter of the EEOC here, is fantastic. I wound up working with this company in a local grievance procedure with people that had their own individual biases. They weren't trained, and I wound up having to quit anyway. The benefit was that I started my own practice, and I never looked back, and I've been a successful professional ever since. So the idea that this commission is going to make a material difference on people's lives is a fallacy in my mind. It's going to be a lot of other things working together to create the kind of conditions to make people's lives better. And I'm somewhat concerned that this has been freighted with a lot more than it's going to actually do. And it was largely symbolic, and we don't even know. We do not even know how much it's going to cost, and we don't know what it's going to take away from in terms of other programs, like, that we know will make a difference in people's chances in life.
So.
And as somebody who changed her mind quite dramatically over the course of this, I'll say that I think where we've come, and we have our staff to thank for just being, you know, working so diligently to get us information, to work with the EEOC in particular, we have a much better system than we started out with. And I had to come to the realization myself, and I think it's a realization, it's certainly my belief now, that this is going to be largely symbolic, and that's what's important about it, is that, you know, I had to strip away my need for numbers and for, you know, being sure that the, you know, people I care most about will be served, et cetera, to believe the folks who are talking to me. And that's why I came to where I am. And we'll see. I mean, time will tell. But I think this will inform the part of the Human Rights Commission I care the most about, too, and will actually help the part that's going to look into the systemic and institutional discrimination in our community. And I believe this is the best avenue. But we'll got a second reading.
Any other comments? Okay.
Do we want to read it out loud?
No,
we don't need to.
That's fine. It'll be posted when? Where? It'll be posted online soon? Somewhere?
This week.
Yeah. This week?
Give us
where?
The end of the week to make sure. It'll be posted on the website.
Okay.
Next, item number three is a resolution for $16 million